Prior to that, though, on the 23rd of May, I do know that one, Kieran, because of your good self, and you, Chris, as well. I'll be in Leicester presenting Spelling for Life.
Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that makes time and space to think about pedagogy, teaching and learning, professional development, anything of interest to time-poor but enthusiasm-rich primary teachers. This week, I'm joined by Christopher Such.
Hello again.
And Lynn Stone.
Hi.
Now, Lynn, this is your first time on the podcast. I think
It
lots of
is.
listeners will be familiar with your work, but I thought it might be good to start with an introduction of, you know, who you are, where you're from, and what brings you to us today.
Well, I'm a linguist, so that means I studied the structure of language at university as my degree. It's just a bachelor's degree, but it's not how big it is, it's what you do with it that counts when it comes to a bachelor's degree. And so I went straight from graduation into education. I went into a clinic where children and adults were struggling with reading and writing, and my degree fit really well into the training. Therefore, I just carried on using it, and suddenly 30 years went by and I was still using it. So that's it in a nutshell. I'm based on the Mornington Peninsula in Victoria, Australia. So it's about an hour and a half out of Melbourne. Very beautiful part of the world, but I do a lot of traveling as well. I write books about reading and spelling and syntax and writing and literacy in general. I run a practice where my tutors, some of whom are teachers, work with children and adults who are struggling with literacy. But mostly I create programs and instructional resources, if you like, to do with teaching, reading and writing. And I traveled the world doing that. So I'm very, very, very lucky to do that. So I've always used that linguistics degree. And yeah, I consider myself very fortunate.
And just to jump in, a central part of what you do or have done in the past are those three wonderful books, Spelling for Life, Language for Life, Reading for Life. I think at some point or other, I've recommended all three of those on this podcast to educators. And yes, they're well worth people diving into.
Oh, thanks, Chris. That's really kind. I love your book too. And we've talked about that.
See,
As well.
You're kind of obligated to say that now because I said nice things. I got in there first.
Oh, did you? I think I preceded you with my massive praise of your brilliant book. You're so well loved, Chris. It's amazing.
Very kind of you to say. Anyway, enough of this. Back, like, go on here and interrupt before we both go entirely red in the face.
I think it's an honour to have you both here because I mean your names transcend the education sort of space, you know, and even for someone who I consider myself relatively ill-informed when it comes to literacy, but you know, whenever you know your name is mentioned, I think it you know, people sort of stop and listen, myself included. So we're going to talk broadly, I think, under the banner of spelling. But first, Chris, what you reading for?
Hey, what you reading for?
This week, I have gone back, and it must be the third or fourth time I've gone back to a particular study. It's called Just Reading, The Impact of a Faster Pace of Reading Narratives on the Comprehension of Poorer Adolescent Readers in English Classrooms. It's known broadly as the Just Reading or the Faster Reading Study out of Sussex University by Westbrook and et al, I should say, 2019. And the reason I've gone back to it again is because it's a paper that's taken the education world a bit by storm. Every once a week, at least, I get someone in touch with me saying, have you read this study? And partly I think that's because it aligns so closely with my own biases around what is likely to be a missing element of reading instruction. Because what it does is it takes teenagers, I think year eight in secondary school, and says, instead of very slowly plodding our way through a text, analysing every bit, maybe not getting time to actually read the whole thing for this reason, we're just going to read two books, two challenging, complex books at pace. And they did that. And the results that came out of it seemed to be I would argue, too good to be true. And there was something along the lines of 8.5 months of progress in 12 weeks and more, and close to double that with struggling readers. Now, the reason I just bring it up today first is to stop people asking me whether I've read it, because there's a chance they'll hear this podcast and now know, yes, I have read it. And second is to suggest that the profession might want to tap the brakes a little bit on its interpretation of this study, given it hasn't been replicated, given the results are too good to be true, arguably, and given that there isn't actually a control group in the study. So it's quite possible that these incredible results come about because pupils are just more familiar with their teacher, or they're more familiar with the structure of the assessment that was used to assess progress. So it's a great study, really. They're possibly going to, once this has been replicated, it might have significant things to say about how we should change classroom instruction, but maybe we should be a bit careful in interpreting it for a little while at least. Okay, that's me. Lynn, what are you reading for?
Well, apart from that study, which I will be reading for soon, right? I forced myself to read something that's not academic for a while, but I can't go full fiction. So I've gone with Michael Palin's diaries from 1969 to 76. And that's the Python years. So right now they've just finished filming Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And I'm really looking forward to the Life of Brian bit, because Life of Brian is top three of the films that have influenced me over my life and given me such great pleasure. So it's just wonderful reading that that Michael Palin book. And also, he's just a really nice guy. He's so nice. It's so uplifting to read everything that he writes. He's so uncritical but firm. I absolutely love him. So yeah, I'm reading that, and I'm actually putting quotes from it on Twitter now and again, because some of the things that he's talking about apply to education as well. So it's all very interesting. Kieran, what are you reading for?
That's fantastic. I remember being maybe 11 years old and hearing the conversation about the non-migratory swallows. And and from then on, The Holy Grail was one of my favorite movies. I mean, most people do put Life of Brian ahead of it, and I can see why. But I've got a special place for the Holy Grail in my heart. So mine's not education based. Perhaps we could say that it is, I don't know, human geography. But I've been reading Young Mungo, which is the sequel to Shuggie Bain, set in Glasgow in the 1990s. Just as powerful as Douglas's first book, and as someone who visited Glasgow regularly in the 90s, I can see lots of my own childhood, maybe not too much given the subject matter, but I highly recommend anyone interested in certainly if you read the first, then check this out, because it's extremely powerful. Our focus is going to be on spelling. I think it's fair to say, Lynn, that you think that the English writing system is often introduced to pupils in ways that can lead to spelling difficulties. Is that right or fair? And can you elaborate on this for listeners?
Yeah, I had to think about that. It's not so much as introduced. I think the English writing system, in a scheme where people have a high quality phonics scope and sequence, the introduction to the English writing system with a phonics scope and sequence is an absolutely brilliant way to introduce the writing system. I think what more I'm driving at is that sometimes, even though we get off to that fantastic start with phonics, it then gets kind of abandoned. The English writing system and the other layers are not just phoneme-grapheme correspondences, tend to get abandoned because, well, look, here's my hypothesis as to why that abandonment might occur. You can probably think of a time or a region or a group or a system that didn't have phonics and was doing things like balanced literacy or analytic phonics. You know, let's just take some random words and apply some phoneme grapheme correspondences to that. There are times and that still exist, those times and systems where phonics isn't being used. When people started using phonics, the results that they got, and systematic synthetic phonics as a result of the inquiries into the teaching of reading over the past 20 years in the Anglophone world, when they started to do that, the relief was palpable. It's like, oh, I'm getting results. I'm actually filling gaps. And I'm, you know, there's so many more children that are coming along for this ride of appropriate literacy development. So the relief is huge. And that, I think, has become the main focus, just get them reading. But actually, English is a complex orthography. So although it does consist of phoneme-grapheme correspondences that are very reliable and quite easy and intuitive to teach with a good scope and sequence, there are other layers. And those other layers, I think, are neglected, especially if you just stay at the phoneme-grapheme correspondence level. That is, any letter sequence must be a grapheme for a phoneme. And that's actually not true, not in an orthography like English. English has other layers. It has morphemic layers. It has etymological layers. You know, there are some letter sequences that are there because of the story of the word, not necessarily trying to correspond to sounds. There are things like orthographic expectancies as well. Even simple things like, you know, you don't use CK at the beginning of a word. That's an orthographic expectancy. And a good phonics program will tell you that. There are other expectancies, though. There are other things that are deeper. And if we keep trying to shoehorn phonemes and graphemes into one another, then what happens is children are forced to learn, or try to learn, and unsuccessfully, in a lot of cases, have these huge charts of this is a spelling for the sound blah, when actually there's a different thing going on with the formation of that word. And you can explicitly teach that too. So that's where that's what I mean. It's not being introduced and, you know, causing spelling errors. It's that the actual spelling, not the encoding of sounds, is abandoned or not taught or left to chance. And I think we can do better. So that's my position on that.
I entirely agree. And I think there's an extent, well, I'm going to ask you, I'm going to put this as a question because it's kind of my hypothesis on this, which is that I think that there has been like an overextension of what phonics is meant to do. So people basically think that there's this English is, not contains, but is full stop an alphabetic code. And that's all there is to it. And so our job is to teach phonics. But through teaching phonics, we're going to teach pupils the entirety of this code explicitly. And to not do that, even if in theory it were possible, is somehow negating our responsibilities as a teacher. We have to do this, because if we're not, we're not introducing them to we're not introducing to all of orthography in the way that we should, when the reality is that phonics was never designed for that. Phonics was just designed to introduce pupils to the most common bits of the most common correspondences of that code, so they can learn the rest of it from real text experience. Does that sound roughly aligned with where you're coming from?
Yeah, I mean, I call it getting into the sweet zone. You know, if you look at David Sher's work on phonological recoding, for instance, and self-teaching, he talks about, and again, you know, lots of other research has been built up on that hypothesis and shown to be a very efficient, effective way to get children reading, blending and segmenting, attaching phonemes to graphemes and so on. It's a really, really important foundational step. You're absolutely right. And we want to get children very quickly to the sweet zone where they're self-teaching, where they have a sufficient phonological awareness. And again, a good phonics program is going to cover that and sort of extend that through phonics lessons. We want them to get to that sweet spot where they are able to recode, phonological recoding, and figure out possible likely pronunciations for unfamiliar words. It's such a great goal. But the other part of this is writing. And writing, again, has been shown, and spelling, writing by hand and so on, has been fairly convincingly shown to also help build lexicons, to build efficiency when it comes to recognition as well as recall of letter sequences. And when you start writing and when you start spelling, that's where the other layers come in. And the earlier and better you teach that alongside a good phonics program, the more efficient it is for a higher population of children. And I think we're totally agreed on that, Chris.
And I think this is probably where, I think because the word encoding within a phonics program has got this this correctly narrow definition of, oh, okay, right now we're writing down a word using a known set of grapheme phoneme correspondences. And the main reason we're doing that is to embed a pupil's understanding of decoding. Kind of makes sense to call that encoding. But if then that is thought of as, oh, and that's what spelling is forever and ever, then yeah, it can be problematic. You mentioned David Sher. I think it's not surprising, or at least to my perspective, I don't think it's this surprising that people who perhaps push back on these ideas about the wider breadth of English orthography are often those who are very, very keen on the work of Diane McGuinness. Really brilliant reading researcher, made huge contributions to the field, but she was, in early reading instruction, someone who was very skeptical of what she called late stage sight word recognition, or Erie's work on orthographic mapping, which has seemingly a pretty robust body of evidence behind it now. So I think it isn't too surprising, perhaps, that those that push back on some of these ideas are those that are see a lot of her work as gospel. Just a random aside there.
Now, gospel and the endpoint. And look, Erie's work didn't just have a lot of backing and support and so on, and was well researched. Work from that took place. So further research was embedded, you know, on top of that, to over and over again show with finer and finer detail how orthographic mapping can and doesn't happen, you know. And so the work that Erie came up with, and Kilpatrick and Sher, they all worked together at some point, has been built upon. Whereas I don't think McGuinness's work quite underwent that sort of evolution. It was just very convincingly stated and rested on some excellent principles, but it couldn't be taken, or wasn't particularly taken further in the way that Sher and Erie and Kilpatrick's work has been taken.
I mean, as I'm listening, I have recognized that certainly within the last 5 years, I've been a teacher who has held some of the misconceptions that arise from not really understanding this. Is this a rite of passage, and is the only solution to find out more about the process of reading and spelling and the learning process that happens? Or can we do anything as school leaders to support our colleagues who may be in a similar position?
Well, I don't know about only solution. But I would always say that in education, the more you know about your subject or subjects, especially if you're a primary teacher, boy, you've got to know a lot of stuff. You've got to do the maths as well, and so on. But the more you know about those subjects and how those systems work, the easier it's going to be for you to impart that beyond your Dunning-Kruger expertise, right, to people who you might not be able to conceptualize as struggling with this because it's so easy for you. And spelling is a really good example of that. Yeah, you can get kids reading with some pretty poor instruction in phonics and some pretty low level theories and understandings, but you can't get them spelling very well unless you make it a lifelong journey, I suppose, to understand how words work. And it is a lifelong journey. 10 years ago, you know, I wrote the first edition of Spelling for Life, and a lot of the things I've done the second edition now, and so many things have changed. I'm not ashamed of that, and I'm still learning, you know, as time goes on. So it's not the only solution, but it's a very good one, and one that I would want people to draw on, you know, and move to, because I do a lot of the things that I say are to do with what I see as casualties. So I do run a practice, and I have children who, for whatever reason, struggle to acquire literacy, and mostly it's spelling. Even if reading is something that's not particularly problematic for them, a lot of them come to us because they cannot write legibly, quickly, and accurately. And some of that has to do with balanced literacy, for sure. But the ones who can read, I'm seeing casualties of approaches that say every letter sequence is a sound.
You've got a lot more experience, perhaps, of these really struggling spellers, or from my teaching experience, they were fairly rare, but they did happen, where you'd have kids who were voracious readers who would score almost full marks on a comprehension assessment, but their spelling would be very poor indeed. And in almost all circumstances, not all, but almost all circumstances where I saw that fairly rare combination, The pupil in question often had issues relating to physical coordination. So handwriting was an issue. When I spoke to their parents, they occasionally said that actually there were just wider issues with gross and fine motor control. Is that a pattern you see at all? Or is it, am I from a very limited data set overinterpreting?
It's definitely a pattern. And that would be, you know, in the sphere of dysgraphia. So dysgraphia is difficulty not just with the mechanics of writing, you know, holding your pencil and forming letters and writing neatly and quickly, but also with the text generation, the output, the next word, the next sentence, the next paragraph. So we see a lot of dysgraphic students, absolutely, but also we do see dyslexic students who don't have any of the motor issues, and the dyslexic students basically they constitute a large majority of the students that we see. Those are students who I like to sort of term as they have a potential that's for forming robust mental orthographic images, so putting words in their lexicon that they can easily, effortlessly recall. They have a very low ability to do that. They have a low potential. And no matter, you know, how much you can explain the etymology and the morphemes and so on, you can move them towards their potential. But there are many cases of children where they are just, spelling is just kryptonite. It is just going to be the thing that breaks down when they're under pressure. And you've got adults in your life who are exactly like that. So forming those mental orthographic images for instant recall is in fact something that does exist on a spectrum of ability. And the more that we understand about how words are built and impart them, the better for them. But there will, no matter how good you are, there will be students who find it very, very difficult to spell as well. So it's not the same as reading. That's the other thing that the sort of McGuinness influenced cohorts might have as an idea, that speaking and spelling are reverse processes, and they absolutely aren't. You can be a brilliant reader, you know, a brilliant orator, and still find it incredibly hard to bring a word from your long-term memory accurately onto paper under pressure, no matter what. They're different. They are different beasts, you know, they're really different things. So again, the solution for me always is to try to move people towards their spelling potential, whatever that might be, and to understand that there are limits to that. And knowing how words work helps to push their potential, in my experience.
Very quickly, thinking about what you say and your knowledge of this area, and reflecting on Kieran's phrase, a rite of passage, it does stand out to me that you have started off from a position of understanding linguistics, and it's kind of a lot of people I know who are interested in reading research kind of do the opposite journey. So they start off with schools and then practicalities, and they're into reading research as a result of that. And the more and more they read of reading research, they find themselves going, hang on a minute, I need to know a bit about this linguistic stuff, be it, you know, learning about phonology, be it learning about English orthography more generally, being learning about semantics and syntax and this sort of stuff. And that's kind of the journey that I'm on. I'm now currently wading through introductory textbooks and bits and pieces on linguistics. It's a very short way of saying I'm just really jealous that I studied chemistry at university and not something that actually would have been valuable and interesting like linguistics.
I'm sure chemistry organized your mind in ways that make you the thinker that you are, Chris.
I don't know about that, honestly. I do not know about that. Yeah, no, Kieran's had too many conversations with me to see that as a possibility. Anyway, sorry, Kieran, I'll let you ask the next question.
No, not at all. I mean, Chris, you're responsible for the references section this week, please, because question one, and we've a thousand different. In your blogs, you advocate explicitly introducing pupils to aspects of morphology in the first years of education. Could you explain what you think this might look like?
Well, I call it the three conditions. So I've talked about it so much that I've actually managed to boil it down to three conditions. And the three conditions for introducing morphology, in my view, right, this is just my view, but has been very workable for the children that I work with, and not just the children that I work with, but the children, the people that I train who also work with children. So overall, I'm getting lots of great feedback on this, but it boils down to this, right? When you want to get children to understand that we have not just a phonemic language, but a morphophonemic language. So that is one where words have got bigger sections, not just letters and sounds, but they've actually got these meaningful units as well, or these structural units. I want them to get from A to B really quickly. To do that, these three conditions must be met. The first thing is children have to be able to reliably form, transcribe, and read certain letters. And the letters that I put forward in my morphology scope and sequence are E, R, N, and U, right? They've got to be able to form them, not just read them, right, on flashcards or whatever. They've got to be able to have the pencil stroke that will form reliably a legible facsimile of that letter. So R, so E, R, N, and U. They've got to be able to do that. They've got to be able to transcribe them. So what I mean is, when I say R, I want, you've got to reliably be able to write an R. Or if I say E or E, you've got to be able to write an E, right? Bare minimum. And they've also got to be able to read them. And usually most children satisfy those, that criterion of reading, but not necessarily forming and transcribing. So if they can't do that, that's where your energy's got to go, because they're not going to have much hope of forming those mental orthographic images that we talk about so much if they can't form and transcribe those letters, amongst others. I'm not saying that your scope and sequence has to begin with E, R, N, and U. It's wherever you are on your scope and sequence. And when you've done that, you've satisfied the first criterion. So that's the first one, right? Does that make sense? Ooh. an icon for those who are just listening, an icon, a thumbs up icon just came up because I was just gesticulating. Anyway, second condition. When students can reliably count up to three syllables orally, they don't have to name the syllable type, and don't get me started on syllable types, or do if you want, but they've got to be able to reliably segment a word into, you know, or count. They don't even have to segment it. Tell me where the syllable breaks are. It doesn't matter. But if I say dinosaur, can they go dinosaur? Can they tell me there are three syllables in that? And the reason three is this magic number is because a base, every word is a base, so that's one syllable. And mostly prefixes and suffixes are syllables as well. Re, ing, not all of them, some of them are just letters or sounds. Yeah, but if you've got a prefix, base, suffix construction, that most of the time is three syllables. So I want you to be able to count up to three so that you can prepare for the word that you're trying to spell or study or understand. So that's condition number two. And condition number three is when students have studied the word do and its family. And I say and its family because a word like do, irregular verbs or tricky words or hard words or whatever you want to call those high frequency words, are often ones that will subvert this wonderful phonics teaching that you've been giving them. I mean, the letter O, right? It's O. And it can say O in an open syllable, or when there's an E close by, right? Or when it's in a vowel digraph, like the O in boat and so on, right? Suddenly in do, which is an incredibly common word, be, do, and have are the three most common verbs in English, and they're all irregular, right? Suddenly in do, the O is going ooh. So I choose that one because when you get to do, there are other words that children already have and you know, they're there in their phonics scope and sequence. But do is great because immediately you can link that to go. You know, do and go, they go the same way. Do, done, go, gone, do, does, go, goes. And they have the same, you know, that same sequence, even though the pronunciation is different. And that helps to get children into this idea that it's not just phonemes and graphemes, right? It's not just phonemes and grammar, there are other things. So once they've done all that, then you've got do. And the first thing that you can do is put that up on the board and go, okay, we're doing morphology now. I'm going to put these two letters, U, N, un. And when they go together, they denote not. When I put it next to do, I've got un plus do. How do we rewrite the new word? Undo. There you go. You've got a prefix. Now let's do it with re. I'm going to do it with re. Do you see how that works? Redo. And I use prefixes first and this irregular verb. Thus, in a very scaffolded, non-scary way, We're lifting the lid on irregular words in English and also showing children that we have a morphophonemic language.
I absolutely love that. I mean, I love the idea of, I mean, it makes sense with, you know, UNER in particular as well, because you can start to use that in other areas, as you say, can stuff. But with E and R, you can also start to look at, you know, you've taught fly, flyer, or etc. I was about to say doer, but I'm not sure that's a particularly common word in English. And also, I love this. I love the idea that we're sensitizing pupils very early doors to. I mean, it's not always going to be syllabifying for the reasons you suggested, but we are introducing pupils to the idea of saying we can look at these bits. Yes, we can look at them in terms of them being morphemes. They have certain meanings, certain sometimes certain spelling patterns that go alongside them. But we're also saying explicitly we can look at chunks of words. And unless I'm much mistaken, there are otherwise really quite good phonics programs that don't pay much attention at all to teaching pupils about syllabification, about breaking words into chunks so that they can, you know, decode them, even if their working memory is otherwise going to be strained. So yeah, a lot of reasons to really like that idea. I guess a follow-up question then is, would you be tempted when you present something like this to use something like I'm trying to remember the name of them, you know, the visual diagrams where you have a base in the middle. What are they called?
Word matrices.
Yes, word matrices. Yeah. I should know. I think I've got one. I think I put one in my book.
But, home somewhere.
But would you be tempted to use that kind of visual representation?
For the very early years, possibly not, because making a matrix, that in itself is something that benefits from explicit instruction and can be a bit fiddly. So, I wouldn't say don't do it, but in terms of cognitive load and what's interesting here, if now you've got this matrix as well, I don't know, for me, for some reason, instinctively, I would isolate them for now. Getting into matrices is a great idea, but you've got to know what you're doing, because it is garbage in, garbage out when you're making a matrix. So you've got to be really careful with your word sums and so on. In terms of, again, that those very early years, word sums are good. Word sums are the basis for matrices, and there's no reason not to move on to matrices. But the other question, the follow-up question I usually get is, well, why are you doing prefixes? In every scope and sequence I've seen, when people are bringing in morphemes, they've got S and ED and ING. Do you want to know the answer?
Yes, please.
Well, suffixes are, a lot of the time, the E and the ED and the ING and so on, are grammatically complex. In terms of denotation, what they denote in oral language, we know instinctively as native speakers what they denote. But actually talking about, you know, defining them and saying to students, well, ING will put a verb into the continuous tense or so on, that's grammatically complex. Whereas re and un, well, that's not, or again, right? Also, suffixes tend to make their bases change, or can make their bases change. So at that morphemic boundary, sometimes there's change. And that's a complexity in itself as well. Whereas re and un, again, they don't make their bases change, or they don't change in order to accommodate their bases. So from a simplistic point of view, getting from A to B, we have morphemes. Re and un are my go-to every time.
It's interesting you mention that, because I think the first explicit mention of, well, they don't call it morphology, but the first explicit mention of prefixes and suffixes in the national curriculum is year one. And I've got it in front of me, but I'm not going to scroll through it all now. From memory, there's lots of suffixes, as you can understand, because of the utility of them. So yeah, as you say, there's pluralization, there's the superlative, etc. There's all of these suffixes, and I think the only prefix they mention is un, as far as I'm aware. But it totally makes sense, because yeah, a lot of what's also mentioned in that year one curriculum are some of the things that you need to do, some of the spelling patterns that we see with suffixing. So it's immediately introducing that complexity, and that isn't the end of the world. But if we just want pupils to understand the idea of morphemes, then perhaps introducing them in a way that doesn't immediately deal with that complexity is a good idea. Well, you've got me convinced, at least.
Oh, I'm glad. We'll see what everyone else says.
I think it's brilliant. I think it immediately feels like the whole tall and grey thing in maths. It feels like pupils who have this knowledge early on do half the work for twice the payoff, and if you don't, you do twice the work for half the payoff. So it feels like this is something I think teachers should really, really consider. And the way you explain it makes it seem eminently sensible, but also actionable, I suppose, is probably the verb I'm thinking about.
Yeah, and little kids dig it. That's the other thing. Children are instinctively driven to learn the conventions of their language, whether it be oral or written, if they are dealing with print. They are curious about this stuff and they like it. It makes them feel like experts and understand things beyond letters and sounds.
You're an advocate of teaching pupils particular spelling patterns, something that certainly appears to be borne out by the research on the subject of spelling. Could you share some examples of valuable spelling patterns and how they might be introduced to pupils?
Yeah, again, I'd go to the irregular words. So we have this mother list. It's like the kombucha SCOBY of all word lists, and it's called the Dolch list. So Edward Dolcher in the 1930s came up with 220 words that, by various estimations, were sort of made up around 60 to 80% of all words spoken and written. So it's a really good idea to learn those 220. Within that list, a good half of them are irregular in that they don't conform to your basic phonics scope and sequence or your default phoneme-grapheme correspondences. So what that does immediately is present this problem. Well, how do we explain them? And various solutions to that problem have been, oh, just memorize those ones. Just memorize them. Put some lines around them and memorize the shape. Just memorize them by sight, or even this new thing, this heart word thing, where we're going to put a heart over the bit that's irregular, which is a half step. And that's really good. But what I would do is I would take that list and I'd look at the ones that don't, that already confound your phonics teaching and start with those. So one of the very first ones is was. How often do you see, was being agonized over on social media by teachers? How do we teach that? Because the A, we have, it's a, and S is actually the letter S denotes the sound or indicates the sound z more than it indicates the sound s. But that's a story for another day, right? It's all to do with voicing and not voicing. So we'll take was. That's a really good spelling pattern because what it is something I call the W effect. So when you see W before the vowels A and O, watch out. The W often has an effect, not all the time, but often. So we've got words like was. If I took away the W just as an experiment, we'd now have as. The A would resort to this a sound, this lovely regular a sound. As soon as there's a W there, the W is like making it do a different thing and going, oh, that's the W effect. And it works for was and want and wash and wand and swan and wasp. And then it works also, you can expand that out into, well, even words with the sound w straight before what we're spelling with an A, like squash, yep, quart, and so on, right? That has a W effect as well. That's a really good spelling pattern. It stops us from going, okay, so the letter A can say a, or it can, what's the word, represent the word, the sound a or a or o. That's a lot of code to learn, where actually what we have is an environment here, an environment where a letter is having an effect on another. Great spelling pattern. Another one that I strongly recommend, as soon as students are able to blend and segment consonant, vowel, consonant words, is final silent E. The E on the end of a word is not part of a digraph, right? It's not joined to another letter. What it's doing, it's a switch. It's a switch that goes on, off for various things, right? It's one of the ways that the orthography takes 26 letters in this language and recombines them so that we can express hundreds of thousands of different words. It's an on-off switch, right? It's a really good spelling pattern. But what, again, an approach that sort of says all letter sequences are phonemes, what that does is it takes that E and it's sort of lumps them together with the preceding consonant or even a vowel that precedes it, calling that a split digraph. That's not what's going on. E is an on-off switch. We don't use things like umlauts in English. Other writing systems do. We don't use cedillas, circumflexes. We don't use those lines that go up diagonally and up and down diagonally and so on. We don't use any, we don't have diacritics in English. What we have is recombination of letters. And the letter E is one of those ones that recombines. So the most common thing that it does is it indicates that we can say the preceding vowel as its vowel name, A-E-I-O-U. It's not that that digraph suddenly got split somewhere in history. That's not true at all. It can do other things, like it can change the C and the G on the end of words. So the word rag, well, if you put this switch on with an E, now we've got rage. Not only is it indicating that vowel name, but it's indicating that the G is making a J sound. The alternative, again, to the rag-rage distinction is, well, you could teach the split digraph AE, or you, and you can teach that, that GE is a grapheme, but which one is it in rage? You can't have it both ways, right? Because it's neither. It's final silent E being an on-off switch. So that that pattern almost is the linchpin of the system. Learn the jobs of final silent E. There's lots more jobs that it does, but a finite set of jobs, nevertheless. If you want to know what E's doing on the end of a word, just take it away, see what you're left with, and you'll find the answer. That's a much better thing to teach than a whole bunch of code with E on the end.
Would I be right in thinking that it also operates in kind of just boring old grapho tactic terms to say, like, we don't like words ending with this letter. So like letter V, for example. So you know what, we're going to put an E on the end of it. And that's come about. Yes, there are historical reasons for that relating to, I don't know, how monks might have transcribed something or whatever it might be. But in effect, it's to do with keeping certain patterns within the writing system that people have just kind of generally agreed upon.
Yeah, there are five letters in the English writing system within that core of the, you know, when standardization of spelling took place, that printers and orthographers said that these can't be at the end of English words, I, J, Q, U, and V. The letter E comes in to stop words from ending with those letters. But in the case of J, we convert to G. So you've got cage and badge and so on. That indicates that we've got an English word following all of those rules. And when you've got words that end with I, J, Q, U, or V, you know that they're borrowed, or that they're acronyms, or that they're abbreviations, or they're, you know, something else going on with the system. So again, that switch with E tells you so much about the system, stopping words from ending with illegal letters. It's one of the jobs that it does. Great spelling pattern. Wonderful. That in itself, without anything else, could tell you so many stories about the system.
I think what you say about split digraphs is going to be particularly of interest to listeners as well, because obviously that is a phrase that's so deeply embedded in the vast majority of phonics programs. I mean, thankfully, when I speak to teachers, usually when I ask them to tell me, well, what do they think a split digraph is, they don't tend to say, oh, once upon a time, there were these, you know, they work together and now they've been split. They almost ignore the phrase and say, oh, it means that that E on the end is telling us something about the sound represented by the one before. So I think in most cases, the name of it isn't as problematic as it might have been, but it is a bit of a shame that it's got that name, I think.
It's got that name, but it's also got that symbol. Okay, so you've got vowel line E, and that's a piece of code that children are supposed to somehow learn and draw from independently. And again, it misrepresents the system. And I think it also has, well, look, this is just my opinion again, but in terms of transfer and self-teaching, which is how we started this conversation, that piece of code has far less utility than this is a switch that can come in or out and give you the difference between pin and pine. Right.
No, just out of curiosity, would you, if someone, say, represented that with not necessarily on a spelling wall for kids to look at and say, OK, when I see this, I spell this way, put that kind of aside. But just in terms of explaining this idea to pupils, if they say, I don't know, draw an arrow from the E to the A, just to say, look, what, when we see this, sometimes when we see this final silent E, as you describe it, it's having an impact potentially on that previous vowel. Not always, you know, have, live, etc., but it can have that impact. What would you say if you saw, say, a teacher using that as a way to explain it compared to, say, the lines, the letters either side of a particular line?
No, that's great. What that is to me is dynamic. It's actually showing that relationship. We do a lot of marking of words, of irregular words, showing relationships between letters. So in my view, it's really telling the story, and it's giving that visual support as well. It's the bit that I have a problem with is learning it as a piece of code rather than this can be taken on or off. It's a switch, and it's a thing of itself. It is a marker, not necessarily part of a pair, if you like.
Yeah, and I get entirely where you're coming from with that, you know, because if you when you start thinking about suffixing and then that E comes off, and it's like, well, hang on a minute, if pave has become paving, is this a completely different bit of code now?
Exactly.
When it's like, well, no, not really. We've just suffixed this word, and one of the things that we know about final silent E is that it can do, you know, X, Y, and Z. So yeah, I agree with that. I think a lot of this comes about because, as you said earlier, English orthography is messy, for want of a better phrase. Really messy, wonderfully fascinating, but really messy. And there is a desire to find an elegant, a more elegant description of it than what we can really put together if we're just honestly looking at the way the writing system works. Does that sound fair?
Well, I'm a little bit. I would lean towards it is actually elegant and
Oh,
not messy,
really?
incredibly elegant, very, very reliable, and reliant on principles that can be explicitly taught in the the primary years, but they have to be taught by a teacher who knows how that system works. Now, teachers are not given that on a plate at teachers' college, right? There is none of that in there. So what they have to do is go and learn it themselves. Again, a vast generalization, but a lot of people get into teaching because they are quite good at words, right? And they did find reading easy, and they do enjoy that literary side of things. So they're in that lucky population that forms very easily mental orthographic images of words. And therefore, they don't need to know what the system is. And so, again, we've got that Dunning-Kruger thing of, well, I didn't need to know that. So therefore, why should I have to explain that to anybody? There is a population of children where we're trying to move everyone towards their spelling potential that will really benefit from knowing that because they can't just statistically learn that for spelling. So my argument is, look, it's incredibly elegant. And actually, there isn't a word in English that can't be explicitly, frankly, and easily explained to very, very young children as to why that letter sequence is that letter sequence, except for Worcester, Chumley, like forget it. Right? But we're talking about the first 220 words. Every single one on there is elegantly spelled, put together for very specific good reasons that repeat over and over again in the language.
Yeah, I think when I think of it as inelegant, I'm perhaps this is more subjective than anything that I can put onto into objective terms. I just see things like like Slovak, my partner Slovak, and I read certain words, and the fact that I, as someone who doesn't speak any of the language, can learn basic correspondences and then be able to recognize the vast majority of words immediately. Is that there feels like there's a sense of, so when I say elegance, I think I might mean convenience as much as anything.
Well, you mean transparent, and there are
Oh,
lots of
indeed.
transparent orthographies, but the hard work is done usually in a transparent orthography in terms of the morphology and the syntax, case, gender, number. These are hard things to learn, right? We don't have a very complicated morphological and syntactic structure, comparatively speaking, to other languages. So, what you may find sort of easy at the beginning, there are other aspects of the language that are far more complicated than English orthography.
Mark Seidenberg describes this as, you know, I don't think he uses the phrase like swings and roundabouts, but there is a little bit of an element of that. So Slovak, for example, you know, exactly aligns with what you're saying there, in that the alphabetic code is transparent, it is a shallow orthography, and yet when you get kind of deeper into it, you find that there are 16 different ways to say the vast majority of verbs, because it depends whether you're talking about what kind of object is it that that verb is interacting with, and what kind of what is the gender of the person saying it, etc. And it gets, yeah, remarkably complicated. It's just the initial spelling and initial recognition of words that perhaps we have it slightly harder in English compared to other languages.
That's what feeds into the myth and legend that the Finnish system is amazing and children don't start formal education in reading until they're, you know, in their third year or whatever. They've got transparent orthography, right? The runway is like really short to self-teaching when it comes to that. We don't have that. We've got a really long runway, you know, and so it's best to get into the weeds as quickly as possible with the orthography so that that automaticity, you know, can be achieved as quickly as possible. It's very easy to achieve that in transparent orthographies. Even you were talking about Slovak, German transparent orthography. I understand. I can read anything in German with a fairly decent German accent. But there are 16 words for the word the that you've got to choose depending on three genders. I mean, language is the outer expression of our inner thoughts. Of course it's complex. We're humans. We're incredibly complex creatures, you know, so at some point it's going to be complex. It just happens to be in the orthography in English.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned German, because unless I'm mistaken, there's in German, because of the relatively shallow orthography, when people are trying to measure reading difficulties for those who have them, rather than looking at all at the accuracy of word recognition, almost immediately within, you know, 6 months, 12 months, whatever it is, they're not looking at accuracy. They're purely looking at speed, because even those with exceptional reading difficulties, in almost all cases, are fine with word recognition because of the simplicity in that sense of the orthography. So yeah, we see that play out in practical terms.
Yeah, I really love the work of Jan Hasbrouck at the moment on fluency and the fact that oral reading fluency measures can be incredibly accurate predictors of people being at risk for you know, difficulty with reading. That ties into it very nicely across languages.
Oh yeah, don't get me started on that. Like the number of primary schools who don't assess, don't use oral reading fluency assessments, don't have that as the centre of a systematic approach to assessment astounds me. And the number of teachers I've seen and they might say in some cases they're year three, year four, year five, and I speak to them and it's nearly, say, it might even be the summer term or nearly Christmas or whatever it might be, deep into their teaching year. And I'll say to them, have you heard every pupil in your class read? Do you know what their reading sounds like? And often they'll say, well, no, not yet, but I've got their comprehension score. And yeah, well, comprehension assessments can be useful as part of a system. In diagnostic terms, they're almost useless, certainly on their own.
I know. Preaching to the converted, Chris. The other thing, though, is with fluency, I just need to make this point because we are talking about primary education. Sometimes, though, people do, again, grasp this idea that oral reading fluency is a great indicator and so on, and then that becomes the goal. And then words per minute become what's on the IEP. You know, they have to achieve this many words per minute if we're going to, you know, stop giving them special ed. That's a problem too. So caveat, it's a system that's got lots and lots of factors in it, literacy acquisition, and we need to be really aware that there isn't just one thing that we can measure and work on.
Yeah, and generally speaking, I think that where schools try to get kids just to read quicker, there are issues that that causes, because they start to not actually deal with accurate word recognition, and it's that, yeah, that is the source of long-term fluency development. You talked about Eri's work and Cher's work earlier, and orthographic mapping and the self-teaching hypothesis. And that stuff really depends on you accurately decoding the words, looking at all of the letters, rather than just prioritizing pace, which can encourage pupils to start guessing at words again.
Yeah. And if pace is prioritized, a lot of the time what you're measuring is anxiety rather than what they can do in their heads, which is the important place.
And dare I say, there's also issues relating to, you know, if you see reading fluency, I mean, I really value it as an assessment. And I also value explicitly teaching it and working on it through things like repeated reading, wide reading, etc. But if you assume that it's an assessment that's going to be accurate for all pupils, then what about pupils with speech disfluency? And I think I dare say it was you that possibly, raised this as an issue with me and suggested that actually maybe it's something to bear in mind. And it's, yeah, it's a good point well made.
Valuable tool, but yeah, it's one of those things that you have to triangulate.
My youngest actually, he's year two, and he wasn't allowed to progress groups because he wasn't reading a certain number of words per minute. And it's not the school. The school are fantastic, but I think this is protocol. And I could see him. He reads every night with us, reads every day with, whenever whoever picks him up at school. And if he wasn't as resilient, it could have gone, he could have been off the reading train, so to speak, very early on. So I can see where you guys are coming from.
There are similar issues with things like prosody as well, in that I remember someone pointing me towards or showing me a Rozinski rubric that they ticked off with kids. And the bits they were looking at were the bits that related to prosody, things like intonation, etc. And they were saying to me, this kid, they're reading at a good pace, etc. The comprehension seems fine, but there's just something not quite there. And then I heard this child read aloud. And I thought, oh, I can see where you're coming from. And then I heard this child speak aloud. And I thought, no, this what you consider to be slightly monotonous sounding reading, that's their natural spoken voice. That's so we have to, I think we have to be really careful with prosody as well and recognize that this is relative to the voice of the individual pupil rather than, this objective measure that we can necessarily identify so easily.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the formula for fluency, basically you measure fluency with three things that you're looking at. One of them can be measured really accurately, and the other two are much more subjective. So you've got accuracy, word accuracy. You either said the right word or you didn't. Right? You can measure that incredibly objectively and get a very, very high quality score and picture from that. Then there's speed. There's the automaticity, if you like, right? So rather than I'm not sounding it out, I automatically read that word. That's something that you can measure with slightly less accuracy because sometimes children do guess. Sometimes children aren't, really recognizing those words. So there's a little bit less accuracy with that, but then there's prosody. And that's just basically how you as a human think someone else should read something. And it's very subjective. So again, we can only go so far. And none of that is a reflection of what children can actually do in their heads when they're not performing with a stopwatch next to them. So sometimes you are definitely measuring anxiety as well as, I know Rozinski and his Mega Book of Fluency is very much sort of touted as being somebody who supplies lots of great ideas about enhancing fluency. But I was go would go as far as to say that the title of that book would be far better as the Mega Book of Oracy. Everything to and I've read the book from cover to cover. Everything in there is about creating that oracy rather than reading fluency. And we have to be really careful about that. And oracy is great to develop, but again, that's not the be all and end all, and certainly isn't something that's desirable even for some people.
The thing about fluency is that we haven't really necessarily got to the bottom of what the active ingredient of all of these studies is. So we look at things like repeated reading and we look at them in context and things like reader's theatre. And so we start to suggest that, well, maybe the sense of performance and the actual repetition is an essential ingredient, etc. And yet there are studies that compare wide reading, where pupils don't do any repeated reading, they're just reading one-to-one with an adult, getting correction and support where they struggle to decode a word. They do this stuff, and we get similar outcomes in terms of the development of fluency as repeated reading, which potentially has all of these other active ingredients, all of these other ingredients. And so we're not really sure whether it is just. Well, is it just accurate decoding practice? Is that all that there is to a fluency intervention that makes it work? Or is all of this other stuff that you talk about that perhaps relates more broadly to oracy potentially positive for lots of pupils? But is that a key ingredient of actual fluency development. I would love to see. I mean, there's the paper that started my thought on this is one, Ardoin et al. I think it's 2015 or 2016, that compares wide reading to repeated reading and sees no difference in this particular. I think it's a meta-analysis. So I'd love more research that actually explores what the active ingredient here is. I still think repeated reading is valuable because that's a way to organize accurate decoding on a whole class basis. But yeah, I think there's reason to be skeptical about some other elements relating to things like readers' theatre, etc.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, we do something at Lifelong Literacy called the performance piece, where children go over a specific text, a paragraph in a knowledge building framework, of course, right? But they have the chance to go over that multiple times because they're still developing that. So there's, again, this novice to expert continuum. And I think repeated reading definitely has a place along that continuum, but not necessarily forever or at the beginning, or that's I'd love to see research on that too.
Yeah, I mean, generally, I tend to say to schools, if you're in a position, say, where your year six class are the vast majority, if not all, are fluent readers, then maybe can reconsider whether or not the things you do to explicitly develop fluency are as valuable as just reading broadly, which is going to, develop fluency in other ways. I mean, there's still value perhaps in, well, certainly I think in learning poetry off by heart through repeated reading and this sort of thing, but it isn't necessarily, the goal is no longer necessarily fluency development. So
Yeah.
yeah, I think helping schools to reflect and strategically use this stuff in response to where pupils are at in your classroom rather than just a do this with everyone is a, a sensible idea.
Yep, couldn't agree more.
Today's chat has been fascinating. I think there are certainly lots of things that I'm going to take away and go and sort of threads I'm going to try and pull. What was the orthographic expectancy, for instance, as a foreign language learner is something that really interests me. But I think everything will be of interest to teachers. Now, your family holiday back to the UK and Ireland has turned into something of a world tour. What have you got planned for the summer holidays, or for, or I suppose it's the start of the summer here?
Yeah, I just mentioned I was coming to see my folks, and suddenly Ireland went bananas. So I'll be presenting Spelling for Life, which is the upper primary part of Spelling for Life in Cork. On oh gosh, now you're asking me about dates, and I don't really know, but it's a Monday, in May. I think probably the 27th. So it goes Cork, Galway, Dublin. I'm doing a reading workshop, and then I'm doing a talk. That night, a webinar that night. And then the next day in Dublin, I'll be doing Spelling for Life as well. And the day after, I'm off to Belfast and I'll be doing Spelling for Life there. Prior to that, though, on the 23rd of May, I do know that one, Kieran, because of your good self, and you, Chris, as well, I'll be in Leicester presenting Spelling for Life, hopefully. So that's going to be quite a big couple of weeks. And then I'm going to Scotland and I'm doing no work whatsoever. Although I will be seeing my parents, and that's work.
Well, fingers crossed they don't listen to the podcast.
Sue me, mum and dad.
That's
No, they're good. They've got a great sense of humor.
fantastic. Yeah, I'll make sure I link Leicester on the 23rd of May to this episode on Saturday because I'm sure lots of people will be listening and going, actually, I want to find out more. So I'm really glad I'll have the opportunity to do so. It's
So
been an absolute
April.
pleasure. Hopefully, the first of many chats. All that's left to do is say thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thanks for having me again.
Thank you, Lynn.
Huge pleasure. I'm honored.
And everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.